We don't really run on our own. It's just not as fun. So
this is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was John Doe. It's like the
Today is June 14th, and you're listening to Solidarity Journal. I'm your host, Zach Teague. This week, I'll be taking you on a journey through a range of topics. A lot has gone on last week. This is just a slice of the news you haven't heard. These are your headlines. Governor Pat Quinn is allocating funds away from public schools. There's mixed emotions on Capitol Hill. In this week's Police State Blues, a fair citizen is about to receive a huge monetary settlement in a police brutality case. This week's segment will be less depressing than before. Just when you thought it was looking up. Meanwhile, Canadians in Montreal last Wednesday were being shot for marching and protesting against militancy by a militant police force armed to the teeth. Don't miss the Police State Blues this week. Our special guest this week is Neil Seldman from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Washington, D.C. I caught up with Neil in Peoria as he was attempting to persuade PDC and some of our city council members about the benefits of mandatory recycling programs and a greener economy. Stay tuned for my conversation with Neil Seldman later on in the hour. I also follow up with local interest group Peoria Families Against Toxic Waste as they give us the lowdown on the Illinois Supreme Court case and how it's going. Don't miss it later in the hour. Last week in Madison, Wisconsin, the largest protest since the announcement of the budget repair bill lined the streets and the state capitol. Thousands are protesting Governor Walker's drastic cuts to the social safety net and workers' rights. Marches and maneuvers still abound at the distaste of the present governor. Solidarity Journal is proud to bring you news from WIN, Workers Independent News. Find them online at laborradio.org and hear them today, later in the hour. In national and global free trade news, Congress is on the brink of passing a free trade agreement with nations such as Korea, Colombia, and Panama, all while threatening Main Street and working families. Some unions are standing up as the president of the Farmers Union addresses the House Committee on Agriculture. Find out what he had to say later on in the hour. Thanks for listening. This is Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM. It's June 14th. Stay tuned. More news is next.
Governor Walker and the Republicans just gave over $100 million in tax cuts to corporations, and now they're asking teachers and nurses to pay for it, and attacking workers' rights to negotiate for fair benefits.
It will probably cost us between $400 and $500 a month in income. I've tried not to think about it, just be out here on the square. It's not selfish, it's just survival.
I'm just a secretary, and this bill that Walker's proposing is going to cost me over $3,000 a year, not to mention more down the road when we lose our collective bargaining rights.
I believe that the issues that are being discussed here in Madison are not unique to Madison or the state of Wisconsin. These are national issues. Money is being taken away from workers and the tax breaks given to major corporations.
This is Republican class warfare, an attack on the middle class. This is a battle we need to win.
Governor Pat Quinn is holding back $52 million in transportation reimbursements for elementary and high schools across the state, putting pressure on schools that are already cash-strapped. Quinn says the move will let him use the money to make the most out of a federal Medicaid stimulus program that ends at the end of this month. Quinn's office says the schools will get their money by the end of the year.
So we have to manage our resources right now in order to get that match. It's worth maybe $100, $200 million to our state. So I have to do everything necessary to get the most money that we can.
School officials and legislators are condemning the move. State Representative Roger Eddy crosses both demographics. In addition to his role at the Capitol, Eddy is also the superintendent of Hudsonville School District.
How's a school district, after the buses are in the garage and the students are home for the summer, how's a school district supposed to make a cut? Those expenses have been incurred. There's no way that we can do that. This is the most ridiculous proposal I've ever heard.
This latest move by Quinn is another drop in the bucket for schools in Illinois. They're owed more than $1 billion in old bills, stretching back for 6 months. This week's Police State Blues. Some good news. One of our fellow citizens named Tyler Mustard last year filed a federal lawsuit against the city and county of Denver and its officials, claiming he was beaten without provocation and endured false charges that he had assaulted an officer. The Denver City Council is now considering a $117,500 settlement, if agreed upon, would be the second largest settlement in 2 months for the Denver police. The largest payout was for another man named Alexander Landau, who received one of the highest settlements in Denver's history of $795,000 because he was beaten by police after making an illegal left turn. In this most recent lawsuit, the defendant claims he was beaten by Officer Morlock without provocation. According to the Denver Daily News, this officer has a history of using excessive force, including 21 cases in his first 2 years with the department, and was suspended without pay after his recent incident. Tyler also claims that the officer lied about being hit during the arrest. The defendant sustained significant injuries from being beaten with a flashlight and baton in 2008, including head injuries and a collapsed lung, because he was suspected in the spray painting of a van. Prosecutors charged Mustard with assaulting a police officer, but the Denver judge dismissed the case, and the Denver district's attorney did not prosecute the officer in question. According to the Denver Daily News, the city has paid $8.2 million in police and sheriff's department settlement cases since 2006. Whew, that's a lot of money. Now, if we can all look back and remember in 2008 when we had the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado, and tons of money from Homeland Security and federal funds went to militarize that whole area. Meanwhile, the people were marching in the street claiming that two parties didn't represent them, claiming that the nominees of each party is not who they want, and the police were out in force, demanding that their voice be silenced. And it's no wonder that since that amazing increase in force, it's no wonder that the police and sheriff's department of Denver, Colorado, has put out $8.2 million in settlement case money since the year of 2006. It's a police state, and we've all got the blues. No one's feeling the sting of police brutality like Montreal. After the killing of two innocent people by police, a demonstration against police brutality through Montreal's downtown streets got ugly Wednesday night when protesters began throwing projectiles and breaking storefront windows. A crowd of 200 to 300 protesters, many wearing black and some concealing their faces with bandanas, marched a day after Montreal police shot and killed two people. Police maintained a presence throughout the march that wound its way through the streets of downtown, with several patrol cars tailing the demonstration and officers riding along on motorcycles and bicycles. The police presence even extended online, as the Montreal Police Twitter account provided real-time updates of the demonstration, including an announcement that the riot squad was intervening. The crowd chanted messages like, "Police everywhere, justice nowhere," and "No justice, no peace. Just ask the police." in what began as a peaceful protest. But around the corner of St. Catherine Street and St. Urbane Street, right next to police headquarters, protesters began to get a little more animated. The windows on four storefronts were broken by projectiles, and some paint-filled balloons were tossed, with one hitting a police motorcycle. The crowd was quickly dispersed by police, and no arrests were made, thankfully. They've brought the war to our own home streets. We've got to watch out. Take care of yourself out there. Know the law. Know your limits. And be careful. Until next time for the Police State Blues. Korea Free Trade Agreement, the largest NAFTA-style trade deal since NAFTA, could be introduced in Congress literally any day now, unless there is a major blowback of opposition. The proponents of this job-killing deal want to keep it below the radar. That's because a nationwide majority of Democratic, Republican, and Independent voters oppose more of the same trade pacts that offshore jobs, undermine environmental, labor, and financial regulations, and allow foreign contributions to attack our domestic health and other laws in foreign tribunals. The National Farmers Union definitely opposes the Korea Free Trade Agreement and others like it. President of the National Farmers Union, Roger Johnson, testified before the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Agriculture on the pending free trade agreements with Korea, Colombia, and Panama. The National Farmers Union has historically opposed free trade agreements on the basis that the agreements were more likely to increase imports rather than open new markets to U.S. jobs, as claimed by proponents. Vague promises of market access have been too often empty and factually inaccurate. NFU supports trade. Fair, mutual, beneficial trade that seeks to increase human welfare and respects sovereign nations. Need for food and national security, said Johnson, the president of the National Farmers Union. The pending agreement lacks key provisions in achieving this goal. To meet these standards, we must follow the Trade Reform Accountability, Development, and Employment Trade Act, which addresses environmental, health, and labor standards of all countries involved in the agreement, and deals with issues such as currency manipulation. It would also increase inspections on imported food, mandate trade pact reviews, and restore congressional oversight to further agreements. The U.S. International Trade Commission, ITC, projects that the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement will cost 159,000 American jobs and worsen the U.S. trade deficit by $308 to $416 million. At a time of high unemployment, it is unwise to pass an agreement that would lead to even more job losses, said Johnson, the president of the National Farmers Union. The U.S. stands to lose nearly 160,000 jobs, and that is a best-case scenario. That does not consider the fact that South Korea has a history of manipulating its currency and has recently taken similar steps to devalue their currency again, according to the U.S. Treasury Department. Such manipulation would worsen the trade deficit and would cause even greater job losses and higher trade deficits than projected. Johnson pointed out that historically, the U.S. agriculture industry tends to do worse following the sign of trade agreements. U.S. agriculture has a history of generating agriculture trade surplus, said Johnson. We have a very efficient system of family farmers, ranchers, and fishermen, and have historically provided a safety net for agriculture that helps our producers survive difficult times. This has resulted in long-term agriculture surpluses. After America signs trade agreements with other countries, U.S. agriculture's trade balance actually worsens. The National Farmers Union has been working since 1902 to protect and enhance the economic well-being and quality of life for family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities through advocating grassroots-driven policy positions adopted by its members. This has been excerpts from the National Farmers Union news release, quotes from President Roger Johnson as he testified before the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Agriculture. Something has to be said for the greedy capitalists who want to take away all the power from the worker, take away all the power from the smallest man on the totem pole, give it to some other nation in exchange for low-priced imports at the expense of jobs at home. It's terrible. Stuff like this has to end. So what are you going to do about it? Well, I encourage you to get out there, get in your neighborhoods, get in your communities, and spread the good progressive word, spread the good progressive news. Let people know how you feel, how you think, and don't be shy. Don't ever be shy. Well, today is Tuesday the 14th, and in the spirit of not being shy, in the spirit of sharing quality progressive ideas, I encourage you to go to Drinking Liberally tonight at 6:30 at Kelleher's on Water Street, where you can wine and dine with other progressive leaders of your community, other progressive-minded people, and share in the progressive community of Peoria. That's tonight at 6:30 at Kelleher's on Water Street. Terrible news for the citizens of Wisconsin, but it's safe to say it's even worse news for the governor of Wisconsin. Last week in Madison, Wisconsin, the largest protest since the budget repair bill virtually outlawing collective bargaining proposed by Governor Scott Walker inspired an occupation of the state capitol building and massive street protests this past winter, as you all may know. Even now, thousands are protesting Governor Walker's drastic cuts to the social safety net and workers' rights, contained in his 2011-2013 budgets. The budget would cut education funding by $824 million and Medicaid by $466 million. Walker is making these cuts despite giving away nearly $320 million in tax cuts to big corporations. That is insane. We are lucky to live in Illinois. We are lucky to live in Illinois. He's selling the government to the highest bidder. The Republican governor has also proposed allowing local governments to privatize their highway departments and hire private contractors to maintain state roads in Wisconsin. This upset many highway workers who would be stripped of their union representation if highway work was privatized in Wisconsin. Many claim not having union representation would make highways dramatically more dangerous, as it would be more difficult to speak up about safety problems if highway workers did not have union protection. Also, the budget bill would strip police and firefighters of their right to collective bargain over their health care plans. Previously, police and firefighters have been exempt from the ban on public employees' collective bargaining that passed as part of a budget repair bill in March. Of course, a Wisconsin court has ruled that that bill's passage was illegal since it violated the open meeting laws. There are even rumors that Republicans might try to pass a new, less legally dubious version of the ban of public employee collective bargaining as part of a 2011-2013 budget. Since Republicans expect to lose control of the state Senate, as they should, in a series of six state Senate recall elections to be held this July, activists who have been locked out of the Capitol by Governor Walker's administration, despite numerous court orders telling the administration to reopen the Capitol, have responded by setting up a tent city on the Capitol lawn called Walkerville. More than 300 people have been sleeping on the lawn of the Capitol all week long in protest of Walker's attempt to pass the bill. On Monday of last week, there was a large march against the budget by more than 1,000 people led by former Senator Russ Feingold. While there has been a lot of coverage of the recent protests in Wisconsin in local media and national progressive outlets, what hasn't been talked about much is what the protests, now entering their 116th day, have done to deepen the militancy of the people involved. As the struggle in Wisconsin wears on, workers have become engaged not just in acts of protest, but in acts of civil disobedience. On Monday, 25 people were either arrested or cited, including two journalists from the media outlet The Uptake, who were covering the protesters breaking into the Capitol. Activists have also gotten more creative in how they have targeted expanding direct militant action to their targets of corporate power. After the protesters were pushed out of the Capitol, they went to the local M&I Bank branch, a major financial backer of Governor Walker's campaign, whereby protesting it, they forced the bank to close for the day. Activists have begun to draw up lists of banks that pay no taxes and look for ways to resist the attempts of those banks to foreclose on homes in their neighborhoods. The attack on workers' rights in Wisconsin have proven to be a training ground for activists in a lot of ways that are going to pay long-term benefits for activism in the state. Unions stripped of their ability to automatically deduct dues from workers' paychecks have started training activists and shop stewards to collect dues individually from workers each month. Collecting dues individually from workers is a process that involves hundreds and thousands of activists. Due to the law, we simply can't return to the model of having a staff representative do everything for workers and expect to survive as a union. Now we have to actually train people. We have to actually involve people in their unions and make them feel like they run the unions, not their staff representatives. This is going to have amazing results for the labor movement over the long run. While the mainstream media has focused heavily on the change that could come from the upcoming recall elections in Wisconsin, the long-term change is likely to come from the galvanization and training that the attack on workers' rights has provided for activists in Wisconsin. Activists have begun gaining a confidence and creativity in their ability to take on entrenched corporate power, while at the same time, union members have become more involved in running their unions. This promises to have a generational long-term effect, much greater than any recall election for a four-year state Senate term. So it seems grassroots power is growing in the face of adversity. More power to you, Wisconsin. Down here in Illinois, let's stay tuned to WAZU 90.7 FM.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The last 3 weeks have been filled with a great deal of tough talk from the AFL-CIO toward Democrats. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka started the tough talk at the National Press Club in May when he said labor organizations would be spending the summer holding elected leaders in Congress accountable for how they approach issues important to working families. Trumka went farther in a speech on Tuesday in front of National Nurses United. He said unions under the AFL-CIO umbrella aren't interested in supporting a single party. They are interested in electing leaders who will stop the wrecking ball heading toward working family interests. That message was amplified on Friday when AFL-CIO Special Policy Counsel Damon Silvers sent a warning directly to Senate Banking Committee Chair, South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson. According to the Huffington Post, Silvers told the Social Investment Forum conference that if Johnson allows new executive pay regulations to be weakened, he should consider the recent history of Blanche Lincoln. The AFL-CIO helped run a Democrat against Lincoln, triggering a primary election. While Lincoln was triumphant in that election, the labor organization takes partial credit for Lincoln losing the general election. Meanwhile, the Service Employee International Union is launching a new Republican political action committee. Doug Cunningham has more.
SEIU says it's an effort to enable working families to regain a voice within the Republican Party in California, a voice SEIU says has been drowned out by a minority of extremists. SEIU says the Golden California Committee will work to elect legislative Republicans who, quote, share the moderate values that once made the California GOP strong, end quote. Among those values, SEIU says, are rewarding hard work, investing in quality schools, colleges, and infrastructure, and doing right by children and seniors. SEIU Republican members, representing what the SEIU says are its 87,000 registered Republicans in California, are launching the Political Action Committee. SEIU says new legislative district lines and primary election reforms will present a new political landscape in California, and the union says that will increase opportunities to make working family voices heard within the Republican Party. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
Get you a man that's a union man. Join the ladies' auxiliary. Married life ain't hard. You're packing a union card. And a married man has a happy life if he's got a union wife. So you
can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union.
I'm sticking to the union until the day I die. Oh.
Recently last week, I had the opportunity to sit down with Neil Seldman from Washington, D.C. He was in Peoria speaking with city council and county board members and the PDC to offer his expert testimony of the benefits of recycling programs. It was really great to sit down and talk with Neil. He was brought to Peoria by local interest groups who are fighting against the ignorance of our city council and PDC. Neil, who do you work for in Washington, D.C.?
The Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Washington, D.C.
But today you're in Peoria.
Here I'm right here in Peoria. I'm having a very good time talking about garbage to a lot of citizens, elected officials, solid waste people, having a lot of fun.
Oh, that's awesome. But what is your research in Washington, D.C.? Any details about that?
Well, the Institute is a nonprofit. We're 37 years old. We provide technical assistance and research for cities, small businesses, community organizations. We work in the areas of solid waste recycling, energy, agriculture, retail, finance, and broadband communications.
All right. So you came to Peoria for what?
We were invited here by the Peoria Families Against Toxic Waste. They are focused on the solid waste situation in the county. They're concerned about the current planning for the landfill. And the goal is to increase recycling and composting, reduce the use of the landfill so it will last longer, and to stimulate new companies, expand existing companies, and create jobs.
And you came kind of as a persuasion method, yes? You spoke to certain people in positions that you could help persuade and let them see the light and the ease of,
well,
sort of the ease that a community and a city can...
We brought a lot of information concerning best practices from other cities in the country, and also to learn the current situation. It's very complicated. And it's you need to sit and listen and learn a lot before you can make suggestions. And it's been a combination of both things in the last couple of days. We've learned a lot, made suggestions about how things might change, suggested specific companies that could be attracted here, and also how existing composting and recycling companies can expand. The main point that is that there's the city and county can increase their levels of recycling and increase jobs and stimulate economic development.
All through increasing recycling.
Recycling and composting, yes. The city has a the numbers are, as I recall them, about 6,000 of 40,000 households in the city are currently recycling. And that's up from about 3,000 last year, which is obviously good progress, but there's also a lot of progress to make. Some cities are at 65-75% recycling.
Wow.
When I say recycling, I mean recycling and composting. The city right now has a pretty good commercial recycling rate, perhaps 30 or 40%, but the household recycling rate is, I'm guesstimating, at around 10%.
So you brought forth plans?
I didn't bring back a set forth plans, but I pointed out what other cities and counties are doing. What types of companies exist and are expanding in the field. And I made specific suggestions, some of which people thought would not work here in Peoria, such as mandatory recycling, requiring segregation of materials for recycling. I've also made suggestions to implement a pay-as-you-throw program, which means people are charged on the basis of the amount of garbage they generate each week, although they are not charged for recycling and composting materials. Other suggestions involved, as I said, specific industries that companies that they may want to attract, such as plastic manufacturers that use recycled plastic, glass, paper. We also talked a lot about how to expand composting, both at the household level, community level, and citywide level.
And you suggested these to the city council board members?
We not the entire city council, but we talked to city council Beth Akerson, and we talked to county commissioner, whose last name I forget. His first name was Steve. I apologize for that.
Okay, that's all right.
I met a lot of people, so I don't remember all of their full names.
Sure.
And we also met with a couple of the principals in the local hauling company.
PDC.
PDC, and met with their staff. And we met with the Heartland Group, which serves as the city's economic development agency.
Wow.
And I think that's about it. Those about all the people we talked to. Oh, there was also a community meeting at the Universal Church.
Mm-hmm.
We had about 50 people there. We'll be having a community meeting tonight, just about after this interview.
Oh, okay. And how were you received by all these people?
People in Peoria are extremely friendly, mm-hmm. and we were received very well, even if people disagreed with certain of our ideas. But for the most part, people were interested, even enthusiastic, about the examples of best practices that I pointed out are going on throughout the country.
These people are PDC officials,
yes,
city county board
officials.
Just about
everyone we spoke to was very interested.
Okay.
And offered ideas. We had extremely good dialogue. One of the ideas I pointed out was the practice of how to deal with construction and demolition waste in Peoria. In San Jose, for example, in order to get a permit to take down a building, to demolish a building, the company has to put down a deposit, if you will, and they get that deposit back when they prove to the county by certificates that they have recycled 50% of the materials that came out of the building. And there are other things we talked about were encouraging citizens to start backyard composting bins mm-hmm. in their backyard. To eliminate perhaps about 15% of the waste from each household. We talked about certain cities that actually provide rebates to households that purchase these bins, because the households would then be taking out roughly 15% of the generated waste forever, which is obviously beneficial to the city.
Definitely. So what does Peoria have as far as its responsibilities to waste, or lack thereof? What do we do?
Well, right now there is a recycling program. The PDC, on contract with the city,
mm-hmm.
Collects recyclables. Households need to sign up for the recycling program. There's a $50 deposit on a 95-gallon wheeled cart that the household gets back when they opt out of the program or leave the community. And PDC picks up those 95-gallon cart once a month. The materials are taken to a processing center for processing, meaning baling, shredding, etc., and sent off to industry. There are a number of companies that are doing very well here. There's a composting company. There's a construction demolition waste recycling company. There are a couple of companies that are interested in plastic recycling. So there's a lot going on. I don't know all the things. In fact, one of the recommendations we made is that the city or one of the city agencies conduct a survey and audit the number of recycling companies and composting companies and identify them and point out how many jobs they've created and how important recycling is for the local economy. On the national level, more people are working in recycling than in the auto industry.
Wow.
So recycling is, when I say recycling, I mean recycling and composting, it's a bigger industry than the car manufacturing. So it's quite significant, and very few people realize how big the recycling sector is in the U.S. economy.
What are some communities around the nation that have shown the proof and benefits of recycling and composting on a community local level?
Yeah, well, there's one community, Nantucket, which is an island off of the state of Massachusetts. They divert 90% of their generated garbage from the landfill through recycling and composting. The city of San Francisco, which is about 800,000 people, they're at about 75% recycling. Los Angeles, which is a city of about 4 million people, they're at 65% recycling. And both those cities have goals of 90% recycling within the next 10 years. And they're implementing mandatory programs and a variety of programs to get to that level. In San Francisco, the city recently made recycling your household organics, food scraps, food discards, mandatory.
How do they do that? How do they get citizens to comply?
Well, in there are a number of ways that Toronto is doing the same thing, and you're correct in pointing out that there are different ways of doing it. In San Francisco, every household gets a green cart for yard debris, green waste, and now the city is telling citizens to put their food waste in the same cart, and it goes off to a compost operation. Toronto is doing the same thing. They do it a little bit differently. They give each household a very small kitchen-sized container. You line it with plastic, put your food scraps in it, and once a week they're collected by a special truck and taken to a compost. In Toronto, they take it to an anaerobic digestion plant, which digests the food waste into methane, and the methane is used for generating electricity.
Wow.
You could sell it back to the gas utility. And some places are turning it into compressed natural gas and using it to fuel their fleet, their bus fleet,
wow,
police cars, etc. That in Alachua County, Florida, where the city of Gainesville is located, they're building an anaerobic digester, and their plan is to process it into a fuel that will be used for the garbage trucks. The fleet of garbage trucks in the city and county.
Wow.
So a lot of creative things are happening.
Yeah.
And the one of the reasons, well, there are several reasons why recycled materials are so valuable, and that's because the population in the world is growing. It's over 6 billion people now. And half of those 6 billion people live in China and India. And in the last decade, the Chinese and Indians have started to consume resources at the level of Western countries,
mm-hmm,
which means we're going to be running out of resources if we don't recycle and treat the resources with respect, if you will.
Yes.
And at the same time that the demand for resources is increasing, the availability of raw materials is decreasing. The low-lying fruit has already been gone. We've been at industrialization in this country for 300 years, in the world for 300 years, and the low-lying fruit is gone, which is why we're trying to find oil 1 mile below the ocean or the sea, which results in disasters that we've seen in the Caribbean and elsewhere.
Yeah.
It's critically important to us keep recycling and increasing recycling to meet the demands of populations.
Neil, what sort of actions did local communities that have thrived and proven these results, what sort of things did the community have to do to stand up and declare, you know?
Well, it's true. Most, I would say, just about every city that has extensive recycling is the result of citizen action, organized citizen action. I'll give you one example. The city of Los Angeles in 1980, around 1985-86, the city was planning on building five major incinerators to be located in the city, in a city that has had and still does have problems with their air pollution. Well, the citizens organized, rose up, defeated that plan, and since 1986-87, they've been implementing recycling using a variety of techniques, and now the city is at 65% recycling. Same exact thing happened in Austin, Texas. They're probably at about 40% recycling, but they just are right now implementing a zero waste program, and their goal is to get to 90% probably by 2020.
Wow.
In about 8 or 9 years.
Do you see the seeds being sown right here in Peoria?
The seeds are already sown. The embryo, if you will, of the strong recycling economy already exists. As I said before, there are companies that are recycling construction and demolition waste, composting, other types of recycling. There's a lot of capital investment going in the area for increased recycling. I think I think the city and county need to either go to mandatory, go to pay-as-you-throw, and also begin a thorough public awareness and education program. A lot of times recycling and composting, it means a cultural change, and it's very important, for example, for just about every city and county agency to have recycling opportunities, bins in their facilities. Every school should have recycling.
Oh, yeah.
Libraries, etc., as a role model, but also as a constant reminder, a feedback mechanism. Every time you go to the library or mm-hmm. pay your taxes and go to the government, you see the opportunity to recycle. And it could pay off in big ways. One example would be a company is now developing a small-scale paper mill, 40 tons per day, which is very small for a paper mill, producing stationery paper, envelopes, copy paper, etc. And they will only locate in a city if the city can provide 40 tons a day of very clean paper. They don't want to put low-grade or contaminated paper into their machines, which means that there would have to be either an adjustment for recycling in Peoria, because Peoria uses a single-stream recycling program, which means the household gets a 95-gallon cart, and all the recyclables go into that cart. Well, that's a good way to recycle because it increases participation, because yes. it makes it so convenient. But at the same time, the paper gets contaminated and is not of sufficient quality for a company, as I just suggested, to come into town. That company needs 100 jobs, which is great to have in your city. So the city would either have to adjust its single stream program to a dual stream program, meaning two separations, all fiber in one category and all other recyclables in the other. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you don't necessarily have to do that, but you do have to identify sources of about 40 tons a day to attract a company like that. And that can be done because office buildings and schools generate 70 to 80% of their discards of paper, so you could capture that paper before it gets mixed with other recyclables.
Is industries like that, do they exist? Are they strong? Are industries looking for locations like that?
Absolutely. And in fact, a number of companies I'm familiar with are absolutely looking to locate in new places.
Places that do 100%
absolutely.
Recycling.
Well, this paper company I'm talking about will only locate when they can identify a source of the clean material, are working with a city that wants them there. They have to be courted, and they want the city as a partner. In one city, this company, actually the city has invested $5 million in a $12 million plan, so they clearly are partners. But cities can do other things besides direct investment, and that is encourage people to recycle the paper, encourage companies and people to purchase the paper that's manufactured in the same city, and also to provide the basic information and education on how people can recycle. It's called recycling literacy. Mm. And just like literacy in general, mm-hmm. A citizen that's literate is a less costly citizen to maintain, for obvious reasons. And it's the same thing with recycling literacy. If you know how and where and why to recycle, you're a much better citizen than someone who is not familiar with that and does not participate.
Very true. Yeah. So as this throwaway mentality slowly becomes less and less the norm, we'll hope to be planting the seeds for something green and renewable. And hopefully those will sprout right here in Peoria.
Yes, I think the embryonic stages, we're at the embryonic stages. I think that recycling has to increase if the nation wants to maintain the standard of living that it has. And in fact, it's very true that sometimes less is actually more. Less materials could lead to a higher quality of life. And in fact, some scientists argue that unless that happens, the world just not can. If the entire world is consuming at the rate that Americans and Europeans are consuming, there's no way that the world can support 10 billion people. Right now it's 6 billion people. I think by the end of this decade or even earlier, it will be 7 billion people. And it's not the people that are the problem. It's the fact that they're consuming and that we're producing things and using energy and other resources in such a sloppy way that civilization wouldn't be able to be maintained. I could give you a couple of examples. Right now, you could go to a store and buy your beer and soda in an aluminum can. Well, the idea of using such a precious metal as aluminum, which takes an incredible amount of energy to produce, for an aluminum can just does not make sense. You use an aluminum can for 5-6 minutes, and then it's gone, and you have to replace it. Now, you can recycle aluminum, but recycling takes energy, and although it takes much less energy than producing raw aluminum. But on the other hand, every time you recycle aluminum, about 25% winds up as a very caustic acid, a toxic acid. So as you're recycling aluminum, you're also generating toxic waste. My feeling is that the country has to get back to refillable bottles. I'm 65 years old and I grew up with refillables. And if you go to Canada and want some beer, all your beer is in refillables. And the only reason we don't have refillables is that the soda and beer corporations mm-hmm. in the United States figured out that they can externalize the cost mm-hmm. of washing and bringing the bottles back and make people pay for it in the form of garbage.
Oh, yeah.
And as a result of that, the waste has soared. The use of aluminum, glass, plastic has soared completely unnecessarily. And people have been put out of jobs. And there's something else that is important. And that is, when the soda companies and beer companies externalize their cost by going to one-way bottles and cans, it allowed them to have an unfair advantage over local companies. And as a result of that, virtually, I grew up in New York City, as you could probably tell from my accent, and we had several companies offering soda, beer, etc. for consumers, and now they're all gone. Mm-hmm. My favorite was Hoffman cherry soda, black cherry soda. It's now gone, unfortunately. It was a very good brand. And this has happened all over the country. And we've seen this centralization. And centralization isn't good. We want the country remains strong when there are lots of farmers and lots of small business people and small businesses. And right now, we're seeing the concentration of just about every industry, including the food industry. The numbers of farmers are declining very rapidly, certainly in my lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
Number of small companies, and every industry in the country is dominated by 4 or 5 corporations. That's mm-hmm. not quite a monopoly. It's called an oligopoly.
That's right.
The impact is the same. Consumers and government lose leverage over industry, and industry can and has undertaken some activities that are quite gross with regard to the environment.
Most definitely. Well, I hope that you'll keep your eye on Peoria.
I will. I'll be back. Peoria Families Against Toxic Waste is very much involved in discussions. They will be testifying at the siting hearings for the new landfill, and I know I'll be involved in that.
Well, that's wonderful to hear.
And I'll be coming back. This was my first time in Peoria, and I'm sure I'll be coming back.
Neil Seldman from the Institute of Local Self-Reliance, thank you for talking with me today.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you.
I'm with Tracy Fox and Kirsten Sheets with Peoria Families Against Toxic Waste. You might recall a few weeks ago they brought the story of a Supreme Court case that they were taking to the Illinois Supreme Court. And I'm here with them now to follow up on the results of that. How are you guys doing?
Great. Good. We went to the Supreme Court with high hopes. We had been fighting a Peoria Disposal Company and the process that they received permission from the Illinois Pollution Control Board to treat hazardous waste in such a way that magically rendered it non-hazardous and suitable to be disposed of any landfill, maybe even one near you. We've been concerned about this. We believe that the process is unsafe, that it exposes citizens to undue risks, and we believe that the Illinois Pollution Control Board failed to consider the impact on local communities when they allowed them to do this process. So when we lost our pleas to the Illinois Pollution Control Board, we went ahead and filed an appeal to the Third District Court. And we did not receive any relief from them. They agreed that PDC's process was just fine, but they did say that we were a valid party to have standing in the suit, and we consider that independently a victory. But as we discussed before, we still also want to stop this hazardous waste treatment process, so we appealed to the Supreme Court. We had a great day for a drive down to Springfield. We were first on the docket. The courtroom was full, and it was pretty exciting just to be in such a historic building and to see it all unfold.
First, I want to step back for just a minute. It's a very historical and very important point that the Illinois Supreme Court even took this case. They had 300 and some odd cases to review, and they only took 7 to hear oral arguments on, one of them being ours. So it's really a huge compliment to our attorney, Dave Wentworth, and to our group, and that knowing that this is a huge environmental decision for the state of Illinois. So the day, going back into the courtroom, the day, Tracy said, was full. It was very good. Our attorney got to present. They had 2 attorneys and a whole table full of attorneys, but 2 of them who presented, the justices were all very interested in, and there was good dialogue between the attorneys and the justices, and we're really hoping for a positive outcome.
That's great. Any timelines set forth by the court?
Well, unfortunately, we don't expect a decision till fall. Anything can happen with the Supreme Court. They pretty much march to their own drummer and, you know, could make a decision at any time, but the typical turn of events would be in fall. It was a great day for us, and one thing that I think we'll all always remember is we have been concerned about the secrecy by which this process was developed and the fact that no one in the public really knows how they make this transformation, and we found it really ironic that their own attorney referred to it as alchemy. That's exactly the black kind of black magic we do not want
alchemy
in Illinois.
Yes. Alchemy.
That was in her oral argument.
Isn't that like turning fruit into gold or something?
Yes. She said it's sort of like alchemy.
Wow.
The process that they're performing. Yeah.
Well, if, you know, if the Supreme Court is stacked with a bunch of morons, I'm sure they'll win.
Well, we won't go that far. Right. There's a lot of tricky legal arguments, but we are certainly confident that the Supreme Court will see both the validity of our standing to challenge outrages like this and the fact that they don't need to be going on in Illinois.
Well, you got to keep WAZU informed.
We will.
Most definitely.
Well, we'll hear from you again when it comes around.
Yes.
All right.
Excellent. Well, that just about does it for this hour of Solidarity Journal on 90.7 FM WAZU. Thank you for giving me your attention for this day. Catch us next week at the same time. And find us on Facebook. Give us your feedback and your shout-outs. Until next time, Peoria, peace and solidarity.
Radio stations are syndicating the local news. Our state, our company in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is syndicating the local news to Detroit. It's happening everywhere. Well, in Peoria, Illinois, the people that work here in this newsroom and all of you are standing up and putting up a fight, and we're not going to let it happen. So thank you for standing with us and keeping it local.
I might fall off this. So. Thank you for all being here. This is important because local news means that a local community is informed. And if we allow this company to start dividing up and putting money over the interests of this community, then we all lose. You know, I was kind of thinking as we were listening to some of the stories that this kind of has a Wisconsin taste to it.
Yes!
You know what I mean? And I think we have to stop that because this stuff isn't going to play in Illinois. We have to make sure that what we in Illinois and in Peoria in particular do is support people like the folks from Channel 25 and Channel 19 and say no more. This is a local community issue. This is about economic democracy. When countries all across the world are trying to fight for democracy, we have to fight to keep it as well. And so let's fight and let's keep support. Thanks, Steve.
Now let's start with this. When I say fired up, you say ready to go. Fired up!
Ready to go!
Fired up!
Ready to go!
Fired up!
Ready to go!
All right, that's the way I want to hear you talk. Look, folks, this is nothing but Wisconsin over again. This is about taking away from folks like you and me and giving it to the very wealthy. This is all about money. Has nothing to do with this community in the sense that they could care less about the product they produce in this community so long as the money flows to them. So we have to stand together. The NAACP will be shoulder to shoulder with you through this issue as we have been with labor all over the country. So let's stand together. Let's fight this issue. Let's keep the news local. Let's keep the weather local. Let's keep the sports local. Thank you, and we are with you 100% of the way.
Mark DeSantis. When I point to the window, I want you to say, go Mark.
Go Mark.
Okay, now let's put the three of those together.
Yeah. Go Mark.
Okay, now, the last thing is you can do it. Because they're saying they can't take this out of the proposal. So, we're going to say, yeah, go Mark. You can do it, okay?